Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Tony Povilaitis. He's a wildlife biologist, conservation activist, and founder of LifeNet Nature, a mom-and-pop nonprofit devoted to wildlife research, volunteerism, and advocacy. For more than half a century, Tony has witnessed ongoing destruction of wildlife and nature in numerous countries. His conclusions, efforts to mitigate human impacts have fundamentally failed. The only sane way forward is to vastly scale down humanity's exploitation of nature, consumption, and population. His book, Slipping Through Our Hands, Imperiled Wildlife of the Greater San Juans, appeared in 2000. Tony has spent a good part of his professional career working to study and protect the Andean deer called the Huemu. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to start with. So can you introduce us to these deer? Because honestly, before your work, I'd never heard of them.
Well, yes. But first of all, I want to thank you for this opportunity. I am really excited about it. Well, you're not the only one that has never heard of the Huemu. It's if you go down to Chile or Argentina and you say the word Huemu, people will know what you're talking about. This is the Andean deer, as you mentioned in your introduction. It's made a big part of my life since I began my initial study on the animal, which is endangered, by the way, back in the 1970s. And I can get into more about, you know, how I got involved and so forth. It is a deer that's about the size of, well, those of you who are familiar with mule deer and, of course, white-tailed deer in the eastern United States. So it's kind of a mid-sized deer. It's definitely a rugged terrain animal, very much adapted for the Andes. I can talk more about its characteristics as we get into our discussion.
Yeah, that would be great. I would love an introduction to them.
Well, how shall we proceed? Do you want me to explain how I was introduced to the Huemu?
I think I'd love to cover both, how you were introduced to them and also their ecological niche history, how they became endangered, were they once common? What is their role in their larger natural community? What natural community do they live in? Do they live in thick forests? Do they live in plains? And help us also to fall in love with them. So either A, you can start with yourself, or B, you can start with them. But I want you to go both directions.
Well, I guess not to be egotistical, but I'll start with myself because I experienced the Huemu as a wild animal. It's very much tied into my spirit today. It's been 45 years since I first encountered a Huemu in a forest, and that has stayed with me over all these years. And I've had the opportunity to be active, continuing my colleagues in Chile on research and conservation issues. I was 27 years old, I think, about 1973. That dates me, obviously. And I had just finished a master's degree in environmental sciences at the University of North Carolina. It was actually a degree in public health. After I had done that, I went back west, where I had spent a lot of time in earlier years, and I went to the Grand Canyon. On the bottom of the Grand Canyon, I hiked down, and I was camping down there by myself. And one morning, I kind of felt this presence as just about, I was coming out of a deep sleep. And actually, it was very, very close to dawn. I opened my eyes, and there was a deer just like 3 or 4 feet away from me, looking at me, and she leans over, right? And I could see her nostrils. She's getting a good sniff of me. And I kind of put my hand up. And then she just backed off a little bit and stood there. And I reclined again and went back to sleep. Now, I didn't think anything of that at the time. I woke up and had my breakfast and started hiking again. But I sometimes think, I'm not a person that believes in fate or something that would signal the direction my life and my career would turn. But as I look back on that moment, it really was my first introduction to deer, and in a very indirect way, a harbinger of what was to come in my life. And so I had a friend that I was looking for a job at the time in Santa Fe, New Mexico, because my master's degree was in environmental sciences. I was studying at that time mosquitoes and the effects of pest control, the use of pesticides, for example, on the ecosystem. And this was in North Carolina. So I was looking for a job in New Mexico, and a friend of mine at Berkeley, who is a professor there, calls me up and says, hey, we just had a teaching associate drop out of our program. We need somebody to come out and to be part of our natural resources conservation program for the spring. And I said, sure. And she said, what do you want me to teach? And he said, well, you can choose whatever you want. And I said, well, I don't know. How about wildlife in America? And so I went out there and I really got interested. And by the way, the title of my seminar was Wildlife in America, and based upon the book by Peter Matheson, a book that was published in 1956. And anybody who's interested in a really good summary of the history of wildlife and what has happened to it in North America ought to pick up that book. It's a little bit outdated, but it's certainly worth the read. I was very excited about wildlife, did a lot of trips, went to see with my classes to see at California condors. And we took a trip to the Mojave Desert and Death Valley. And I decided, well, what the heck? Why don't I continue studies in wildlife, right? It was kind of a whim. I applied to Colorado State University, their wildlife department, to see if I could get in and do a, maybe a doctorate in wildlife biology. That summer, I went to Canada. I had a great time. I saw some magnificent wild animals of the Northern Rockies. Wound up at Colorado State University in the fall, kind of was looking around for, well, what am I going to actually do? They let me in. It was really amazing because, well, here's a guy with a background in public health. So what the heck are they doing admitting me to a rather traditional wildlife management program? In fact, my advisor said to me when he first saw me, I was standing at the door of his office. He said, who the hell let you in here? And I think the answer to that was the head of the department was kind of a progressive guy who decided that he wanted to diversify the department and include people that were kind of outside of the traditional wildlife management interest, you know, usually farm kids, kids from hunting families with hunting backgrounds and so forth. What happened was that there was a guy who was I became friends with. He was a part-time student. He was going to work on his PhD on deer. And he was an expert. He had a lot of experience studying mule deer in Colorado. He was supposed to go to Chile to look for and study this animal, the huemul, which was, at that time, it wasn't even certain whether there were any left because they had been so heavily hunted in decades prior to that. And so this is a project that was arranged through the Smithsonian Peace Corps program with the Chilean Forestry Corporation, which is actually a public corporation. They call it a corporation. It's like the U.S. Forest Service. We were talking about this. I said, lucky you. You know, I was in Southeast Asia in the Peace Corps and I really enjoyed going overseas, and I'm sure you're going to have a great time. Well, he calls me up about a week later and says, I'm not going. And I said, what? He says, yeah, my wife and I were sitting around one evening watching television, and the news came on. My wife said, what's this? Listen to this. Well, there was a military coup in Chile 6 months prior to that time. And the story in the news was, you know, the military takeover of the country, the violence that was going on in Santiago, Chile, and other major Chilean cities. And his wife said, there's no way we're going down there. So I talked to my advisor and he said, well, you don't have a family. You're a single guy. How about you go down to Chile? You know, I really didn't know a darn thing about it. I wasn't that interested in politics at the time. And I had no clue as to what had happened in Chile. You know, for a lot of, I'm sure, listeners know about the coup d'etat in 1973 that was in part encouraged by the Nixon-Kissinger administration. So there I went. I went off to South America, down to Santiago. I started in Santiago. And so the story begins. I don't want to continue on too much without maybe giving you a chance to ask any further questions. And then I could continue telling you about what actually happened to me when I got to Chile.
Oh, no. Go on. This is great. Keep going.
So I got down to Chile. I mean, it was like I was really shocked because the streets of Chile were heavily militarized. Buildings were broken down and shot up. Big chunks of cement were missing, you know, from parts of buildings that held government officials. And the presidential palace was in ruins. And I remember when I was driving, I was in a taxi going to a hotel, and I'm looking around. It reminded me of something that you might, a scene from post-World War II Poland. It was like very dusty and smoky, and it was monochromatic, you know, and really kind of spooky. So that was my, you know, my first impression. Oh, brother, what have I gotten myself into? Was what I was thinking. But once I got out of Santiago, the picture was very, very different. And once I got into the countryside, it was even more different because, you know, a lot of people, they heard about the coup, but they were not personally involved, nor did they have necessarily friends or family that were harmed by what had happened. Backcountry in those days, I guess it was kind of like what you would expect in California in the mid-1800s. That's how it was. My Spanish, by the way, was pretty awful. And in some ways, I think, especially when I had a few encounters with the military, I think in some ways it helped kind of, you know, slip through the cracks so they didn't suspect there was some kind of a person down there instigating political problems for the new regime. You know, I had no idea really where to look for the Huemul. The Chilean Forest Service, I'll call it the Forest Service until I mentioned it was the Chilean Forestry Corporation. They had some reports from two different places, two different regions of Chile. One of them was in the far south in the region of Patagonia. And if you, for those of you who are not familiar with Chile, it's a very long and narrow country. For instance, from Santiago, Chile, which is the capital, and it's right about in the middle of the country, it's about 600 or 700 miles down to Patagonia, which at that time was super wild. You could only fly into a few places, and from there, the roads were really bad. You know, you could get kind of a bush pilot to take you around, but it was really quite wild. And the other place that the deer were rumored to be, to be surviving, was not far south from Santiago, in an area that was very different from Patagonia. It was about 200 miles south of Santiago, near a town called Chillán. And the interest here was that these were two very different environments. It's like, I guess for an analogy here in the States, Patagonia is to Santiago and South Central Chile as Alaska is to California. And it's about the same distance, too. You know, obviously, the ecosystem, the ecology, the forests, the biological communities are quite distinct between the two regions. And but here was an animal. And by the way, this wasn't just any animal for Chile. It turns out that the Huemul is Chile's national icon. It's its national animal. And it's found most prominently on the Chilean coat of arms. So, you know, it's like our bald eagle here in the United States. In fact, I would think that in some ways, I think the Huemul in Chile has more prominence in the culture than the bald eagle does in the culture in the United States. And that may have to do with the fact that it's somewhat of a smaller country. The Huemul is also in Argentina, but only to a lesser degree. So, but getting back to Chile, so I had to decide, well, where to look. Well, what I did is I looked in both regions. Patagonia was very difficult. It rains a lot. The forests are, for the most part, rather wet. And that means very dense vegetation. And, you know, you can ride, and we did. We rode horses through the valleys. But if you wanted to get where the Huemuls were, you know, and I kind of discovered this over time, that the Huemules were not in the bottom of the valley, at least not during most of the year. And also there was a conflict between the Huemules and livestock in the valleys, and even hunters who would poach the animals at that time. So I did a lot of exploration. It was pretty darn wild in Patagonia, and thought what I found when I got there and I actually got in the field, I wasn't really sure even what to be looking for in terms of sign, but I kind of figured it out based upon, you know, the kinds of tracks and droppings, pellets that you'd expect from deer, say in North America, like mule deer. And then I went to central Chile, and that was like, wow, that was really a very different environment. It reminded me of parts of California, you know, with oak woodland, which you didn't find in Patagonia, drier, but a lot of biological diversity. If you climbed, like, for example, from one side of a mountain over the top and then down the other side, you would come across maybe a dozen different kind of plant communities. In fact, that part of Chile, the south central Chile that I'm talking about, is the area of highest biological diversity in the country. And unfortunately, like most places that have high biodiversity, at least in temperate zones, they are really very heavily settled by people. And of course, that limits conservation opportunities. I discovered that there were actually small groups of Huemules widely scattered in Patagonia. I also decided that it was going to be very hard for me to do a study down there because I couldn't actually see the animals, and the logistics were just awful. Whereas in central Chile, I could take a train down from Santiago, get on a bus, and go to a little town in the foothills and start hiking. Chances are my weather is going to be a lot more favorable than it would have been in Patagonia. So I chose to go into central Chile first to try to do a study on these animals. I also realized that, hey, wait a minute, you know, in central Chile, they seem to be far fewer Huemules than in Patagonia. And so that gave me a sense of some urgency that, hey, you know, I ought to really get started on the population that's perhaps most endangered, and because that could disappear. And I actually, looking back on it, a Chilean friend of mine who's about my age said that, well, remember we had a debate about that. Should you go to Patagonia to set up a study, or should you do it in south central Chile? And he says, well, I was actually pushing for Patagonia, but he told me, you were right. And the reason is that we were able to actually rescue this population south of Santiago, and it's still there, but it's in a lot of trouble. So when I got down there, I heard a story that a campesino, a farmer by the name of Segundo Ocares, he went out looking in the mountains near his farm. He was just really a family farm, because an entomologist, the guy who was studying insects in the University of Concepcion, wanted him to go out and collect insects because of the high diversity of insects in that region. So when he was out looking, he ran into some Huemules. And then he reported this to the forestry people, and that's how I got the information. So I went out and I was looking for Segundo. And so we went out, and he showed me where he had seen them, and we couldn't find them. We looked at a couple of other places. One place, beautiful mountain right near his home. And he said there were tracks here just like couple of months ago, but we couldn't find anything. This area, by the way, is really fascinating. It has a volcano. If you're for those of you who are familiar with Chile, you might know that once you get into southern Chile, there's a whole series of volcanoes north to south. And then in Patagonia, there's one big one, and then you get a lot of coastal breakup of the Andes, so you don't have those big volcanoes. But this area had a really nice volcano that was actually semi-active, meaning it was smoking. And at night, I could see the, I could see it lighting up, and I could see like ashes, ambers rolling down the side of the top of the volcano. So it was pretty darn spectacular. Well, Segundo lived down in one of the valleys that comes off the volcano. And there were a lot of old, basaltic columns that were the representative of the old lava flows years ago. And so eventually what happened was I was kind of giving up on it because we just couldn't find them. And on my very last trip, it was January 1975, I was out by myself walking along this high ridge, came upon this beautiful, kind of just such a gorgeous lake, a small one. And I thought I saw something that looked like deer tracks. But I was out of food and I was going to head down, and it was a really hot day. The seasons are reversed. So January in Chile is summertime. And I started hiking out, and I looked over my shoulder and I saw a really beautiful little cove with these really tall trees, kind of a pristine forest. And I thought, well, that'd be a great place to go and get some relief from the heat of the day. And so I hiked over there and crossed some rock falls and got into the forest and looked. And there, like a statue, was this doe, this female Huemul, just looking at me. I mean, it was like, I just couldn't believe it. It was like I found gold. I really felt that elation of discovery. Especially after looking for 2.5-3 months, it was pretty darn exciting. And on the ground, it was right near a little spring that had come out right where I entered the forest. And the ground was covered with these beautiful Astrameria flowers. They were orange flowers. So, that kind of image really is embedded in my brain. It's just, it was a day, it was 3:30 in the afternoon, and it's one of those moments we all have these things in our lives, when something really hits us and it just stays with us. And this was one of my peak moments in my life when I actually saw that deer. So what was I to do? I did go back to Patagonia for one more look, and had some really heated discussions with people about where I should do the study, because I only had really 2 years. They only had funding to keep me down there for a couple of years. And I had already burned up, three or four months of that. So I really had to get down to business and find a location where I could get some serious biological information on how these animals, as you were saying earlier, Derek, how they use the environment, what are their habitat preferences, something about how many of them are there, what's their social behavior, and above all, what requirements do they have to survive and do well in the end in the modern Andean environment. So that's what happened. I started working on that. Had to use tracks because the animals are extremely shy. You'd be out like at 5:30 in the morning, just when it's starting to get light, on top of a ridge, and you'd look down into this canyon, and you'd see all this, like this chaparral and then patches of forest, and you'd see these tiny little itty bitty animals. I mean, they're not small, but from the distance, and with the scope, you were able to watch them for 45 minutes or maximum an hour, and that was it. So if I was going to get information, I had to learn how to really track them and be able to record those tracks in different types of habitat types, like shrub, forest, grassland, chaparral and so forth. And, you know, I was really lucky because it turns out that, you know, as I mentioned, this was a an active volcanic area. So it had very new volcanic soils, which were perfect for registering tracks. In Patagonia, that was not the case. So doing this kind of a track pattern analysis would not have been possible in Patagonia. But it was possible in this area of South and Central Chile. And so I collected a good amount of data and went back to and had recommendations for how to protect these animals. I went back to Colorado to type my PhD. And back, by the way, I think I was one of the last persons that actually typed my entire, hand-typed my entire dissertation. And that was back in 1978-79. So, yeah, that's what, that's the story of how I did my initial study. And it was very, very, very small. People in Chile, and especially the people who had authority in government, were very excited about it. And as a result of that study, a reserve was created. This was in 1978 to help protect the animals. One of the things that I learned, and which is really important in terms of what to do about land protection for their conservation, it was actually somewhat of a disadvantage because the animals would space themselves out in little groups. So it wasn't like there was a big herd that would use one mountain that would just go in the valley in the wintertime and go back up in the summertime. These animals were kind of spaced out in groups that were only marginally connected to one another. And the difficulty was that in a landscape that was starting to really change because of human activities, these little connections or corridors or links between these groups were starting to break down. So we were seeing a case of habitat fragmentation going on. And that really deeply concerned me. And I had suggested at that time that because of that, we're going to need a very sizable reserve, even larger than the one that was created in 1978. And of course, this presents difficulties. When you have an animal like the huemul that requires a very broad landscape to maintain a population size large enough to remain viable over time, then that becomes more of a conservation challenge because of the inevitable conflicts that you run into with other uses of the land. So anyway, that's that was the first part of my experience in Chile. If you want to know more about the particulars of you know, the huemul, I could certainly say just a few words. And if you have any questions, by all means, just ask me. This is an animal that ranged, as I think I've indicated, from just south of Santiago all the way down to Tierra del Fuego. So you can imagine there's a vast distance there. And, you know, you're talking about deciduous roble forest in the north where I did my PhD work, down through, you know, further south where you see iconic trees like the monkey puzzle tree, the Araucaria. There are forests of these trees. And then you go further south and you start getting into southern beach, Antarctic southern beach forests. And then at lower elevations, you have all kinds of these different biological evergreen communities. And there are a lot of animals and plants that make for a feast for any field biologist. It's just really a remarkable place. Southern Chile and the Southern Andes in general, including parts of Argentina that include the Andes Mountains. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you could tell us more about a more thorough introduction to the Wemu themselves. Do they live in small? How big would a large group be? And also, you talked about threats like from poaching and from habitat fragmentation, but was the population ever large? And what are the population trends? I mean, it's pretty clear they're going down, but how quickly? Is it precipitous? Has it been going down for 300 years? Just give us more of an overview of the animal themselves.
Well, historically, one can only speculate, but my feeling was that these animals were kind of patchily distributed throughout the southern Andes, very widespread all the way from the foothills on the west side of the Andes all the way over the tops of the mountains and down into the pampas, where the terrain was rather rugged. You know, there are some places where we have canyons that break out into the pampas. The Spanish arrived about 1550, and there was a prolonged period of combat in southern Chile between indigenous peoples, especially the Mapuche, the Araucanian Indians, that were the largest group, and the Spanish. And that went on until the 1880s. So you're looking at a very long period of warfare. And I can imagine that during that time, there was tremendous hunting pressure on animals, on larger mammals like the Huemul and the Huanaco. The Huanaco is a small camel, but, you know, very substantial in size and certainly would provide a lot of meat to either the Spanish or the indigenous peoples who were locked into combat. And so I have a hunch that during that time, the Huemuls were decimated throughout much of the southern Andes, throughout much of their range. And so they seem to survive in those places that were obviously the most remote. Some of the early explorers, this was more into the 1900s, found them. There was one old timer. He was a glaciologist studying vegetation and rock along the edges of the glaciers in Patagonia. He, like other early researchers and some of the earlier explorers, mentioned that when they did encounter the Huemul, they were extremely tame. This guy by the name of Scottsberg, I think it was about 1910 or something like that, said that he wrote that he was sitting in the forest smoking a pipe, and these deer came by and they kind of surrounded him. And then when they got a whiff of the pipe smoke, apparently he said they didn't particularly appreciate his tobacco. So it was kind of perplexing that here you had an animal that was reported as being so tame and an animal that had little fear, and at the same time knowing that from my experience, my early experience, how fearful they were of people, how they'd immediately flee as soon as they realized your presence. So it was kind of a little bit puzzling. But so anyway, what happened was after the war, the Indian Wars were over in the late 1800s to the mid 1900s, there was what I would call a great burning in Patagonia and throughout much of southern Chile. And at that time, this region was starting to get settled by people who wanted to raise livestock. And what they would do is, when there was a drier year, most of the time it's fairly wet, it would be pretty hard to burn the forest. But during certain years, it gets dry. And so people would just start lighting up the forest, right? And they did incredible, they created incredible forest fires that destroyed forests over vast acreage, right? And at the same time, these new settlers would also, not only they have their livestock, sheep, goats, and cows, but when their dogs chased down a weymouth or any other animal that they could eat, why, they would kill it and use it as food. So no doubt, this was kind of the second wave after the initial depletion of weymouth numbers during the conflict between the Spanish and the indigenous peoples. Then comes this period of settlement and the burning of the forests and then the hunting of the weymouths. So by the time I arrived in Chile in the 1970s, the forests were still pretty much in bad shape. A lot of the poaching, not a lot of it, but much of it, I think, was subsiding because of the fact that the weymouth became a protected animal. And the forestry authorities in the new wildlife department in Chile was able to access a lot of these settlements and communities, informing them that, the weymouth is protected. It's the national animal, so don't kill it. And the reception was actually quite good. There's always a few characters that are not going to pay attention to that kind of an appeal to protect the national animal. But by and large, people came around. So today, poaching is not really much of a problem at all. We have other serious threats, but poaching, fortunately, has subsided. The weymouth is also part of Andean legend. There was one story, there were several stories, but one of them was that, well, why were the weymouths disappearing? Well, this story started going around that they were actually seeking refuge in a lost city of the Andes called the City of the Caesars, Los Cesares. I thought that was really fascinating because I've never heard of an explanation like that for the disappearance of a wild animal. So anyway, today, so here we are first let me back up. In the 1980s, I kept going back to Chile. And at first I did it on my own. And then I started teaming up with certain organizations to recruit volunteers who could join me, help pay my way, and for research equipment, go down and team up with Chilean, mostly students, because, like in most places, the adults have to work. But students were really great. And then I also had students from the United States. So we had some really, really cool teams of young people that would go out in the Andes and go back to my old study sites, right? And then we would also explore new areas to see if we could find the weymouth in other places. So, but one of the things what became a real concern in the 1980s was that the weymouths were disappearing from my study sites. I was really, this was blowing me away because, I'd go there and I'd take students and we'd be looking and, I'd say, well, this, I explained to them, where I did my study, where I saw animals, how they were using the environment. And I said, I swear they were here. I was sometimes joking, I could have just gone to a little cafe in Chile and wrote this whole dissertation up and just imagined the whole thing. But no, these animals are real. And of course, we did find areas where they had survived. So during the 1980s, it was a big concern, and it had to do with the fact that the landscape was changing. And there were some concerns that were starting to develop over industrial incursions incursions into Waimul habitat in this area. The first of which, in the early 1990s, were well, the first thing was an oil pipeline that was built between Argentina and Chile, and the people, the engineers, said that the best place for this pipeline would be right through one of the reserves that was created. There was a second smaller reserve that was created, but this pipeline would go right through the main reserve, right? So there was a big fight. The Chilean conservationists wanted to have them do it elsewhere. And unfortunately, the government decided that the pipeline company would win the debate. And so they built the pipeline, and it did have a short-term effect. Some of the Waimul groups were displaced from the area along the pipeline, but fortunately, and I knew it would have a temporary impact, but once it was actually constructed and they got all the equipment out of there, then I didn't think it would, as long as they didn't do anything else, which is always a danger when you build a road, then somebody's going to say, well, there's the road there, so let's go ahead and start putting something else in, or let's make a major corridor between Chile and Argentina right through the reserve. So that's always a concern, but it didn't happen. In fact, today the pipeline is there, it's buried underground, and there's no oil running through it. Can you imagine? So, but then shortly after that, and that has to do with Argentina deciding that it needed the oil and it wasn't going to send the oil through to Chile anymore. So politics and economics. But then they wanted to build a second pipeline that would parallel in part the oil pipeline. This was for natural gas. And kind of the same story. Although this one was especially damaging to a particular area where there were Waimuls, because it cut away from the oil pipeline route, went over this mountain and plunged right down toward this river, where it would fall the river out toward the Central Valley of Chile, where they needed the gas for the cities like Concepcion. And one of the most dramatic things that I ever experienced in my life was with a group of Chilean and American students coming out of the reserve, and the only way out at that time was to follow the route. They were putting this gas pipeline in, and I mean, it was just unbelievable. It looked like something from out of, Soylent Green or something, where they were just totally destroying the environment, blasting away at it. There were bulldozers and really super heavy equipment, just dumping soil and cutting the trees down. I mean, it was just, and the students were all in tears. And I'm trying to keep the group together and say, we got to get out of here. So pay attention to what you're doing, because we could have an accident. And we had a couple of Jeeps, right? And, but that was really, I think a powerful experience for all of us, and especially for the students, to see firsthand the impacts of our industrial civilization on the environment. So, and by the way, today that gas pipeline is providing very minimal gas to Chile. So, a lot of times these projects that are supposed to lead to so much a better life for people don't really turn out to be such.
Well, that's
That's not the worst of the impacts. We're involved in a situation. I say we, my friends in Chile and I, who are very much on to protecting the Waimul, are faced with a new project which is far more devastating potentially than the pipelines. I'm sure you want to hear about that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're starting to run out of time. So can you give us just a couple, 3 minutes on that? And then also, we've never mentioned how many Waymo are actually still existing in the wild. So can you cover those things in like 3 or 4 minutes?
Sure. Well, just first on the terms of the numbers, you know, this is an animal very difficult to get accurate numbers on. But the best estimates are about 1,500, with the vast majority of them, with the exception of, say, about 60 or maybe 70 max, the vast majority of them are in Patagonia, where there's been some real success, I should just briefly mention, in conservation of the waymoo, to a large part because of Doug Tompkins. Some of you may be familiar with him. He was a guy who was very successful in business. He bought a lot of land in Chile, and he created parks out of them. Then he handed the parks over to the Chilean government. And today, he is working with the Pew Charitable Trust, I think, and the government of Chile to create, to really build a better system of parks in Patagonia. So that's very positive.
He's not. His wife is. He died a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But his legacy, you're right. Absolutely. Yeah, he died in a terrible accident, actually, from hypothermia out kayaking on one of the large lakes in southern Chile. Very, very tragic. But anyway, just to give you a background. So, that's probably a fairly accurate estimate. It comes from a whole bunch of different sources. There have been a lot more surveys done since my really active time in the field in Chile. And so that that estimate of about 1,500 animals still holds up.
That's not very many.
No, it's not. It's not. And so it's really great to hear the news coming out of Patagonia. The only problem is that eventually the Pew Foundation and Tompkins Conservation, which, as you say, is run by his wife now, eventually they're going to have to turn that over to the Chilean government. There's so many priorities right now for wildlife protection around the world, so especially in the tropics. So there's a lot of competition. And so that kind of brings me to my next point. And I know we're a little bit short on time, but I want to get this across governments are really going to have to step up, and they're going to have to make conservation a top priority if we're going to be successful in that endeavor. So, about 10 years ago, an Italian company proposed a very large dam right in the Waymoo area in south central Chile. And just prior to that, the whole area, and this is a huge area, like, 500 square miles or more, was designated a biological reserve or a biosphere reserve. And that's a United Nations designation. And it's more, the designation is more a matter of intent. And it doesn't have any real legal teeth. And that is really unfortunate in this case, and I'm sure in other cases, because this dam was approved. This is horrible. I mean, this is really horrible. I mean, this is like bottomland forest. There's not a lot of this stuff left. And also, there are traditional communities still in the backcountry where this dam is proposed to go in. And these people, believe it or not, were evicted physically, the ones that would not leave. They were evicted from the area. I was actually there with a newspaper reporter and a Chilean friend of mine, and my jaw was just dropping. You know, talk about environmental injustice. It was just really remarkable, and just from the human standpoint. And then you think of all the biodiversity that's that would be lost with the elimination of this bottomland forest toward this reservoir, this huge reservoir, and all the biodiversity that would go down the drain. Sorry for that expression, but that's what would happen. And so it's been tied up in the courts in Chile for a number of years. The Italian firm that had proposed it and actually started doing construction bailed because, well, they're, I don't know the full story, but they're actually alleged to be a very corrupt corporation. But now the Chinese, they have a foreign investment operation, as you probably have heard, not only in Asia, but also throughout the world, wants to pick up the project. So there's no end to the extraction of resources and the destruction of the environment that's going on in this world, allegedly on behalf of civilization or civilization's needs. So anyway, that's where we are with that. And my friends and I, we've started a foundation called the Andean Huemul Foundation to distinguish the Huemuls in central Chile that are in the higher Andes from those in Patagonia. So we're making a distinction between the Andean Huemul. It's the same species, but it's different in some ways from the Patagonia Huemul. So we're calling it the Fundación Huemul Andino. Yeah, and the idea is to, and I'm telling you, this is the only way it's going to work. I've had debates with quite a few people about this, but unless we get a national park and a large national park, I don't think that those Huemuls will survive. And I was just talking, I was on WhatsApp today with some Chilean friends who had visited the two reserves. They're small, fairly small reserves. And unfortunately, because of poor finances, people are starting fires. There are dogs that are getting into the reserves and livestock that go along with the dogs. And dogs and Huemuls don't mix. Dogs are one of the main threats to the Huemul. People leaving trash, and so I'm of the firm belief that unless we get the highest level of protection, meaning a national park, that eventually those Huemuls will disappear. And a national park draws it. I mean, it should not, it's not true in all places in the world, but it tends to draw the most financing. The national parks in Chile are actually fairly well run, and they're fairly well financed, and I don't think that'll change. Whereas these reserves, they're forest reserves, right? And to some degree, they're multiple use reserves, so they don't get the financing for protection as do the national parks. So that's why we're pushing hard for a national park for the Huemuls in central Chile.
Well, thank you for all that. And very, very quickly, how can people find out more about this foundation?
Well, it's just getting started. The best thing to do would be to contact me. And they can do that. I have a web page under, I'll say this slow. It's called Life Net Nature. Three words, life, L-I-F-E. Net, N-E-T, and then nature. And so we have a web page, lifenetnature.org, and they can contact me through that.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for saying all that and telling us about this deer. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Tony Povilaitis. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.